It's often said that fact is stranger than fiction, and that statement certainly applies to our next story. In 2005, Esquire executive editor Mark Warren and writer-at-large Tom Juneau went to Mississippi, where they interviewed Hurricane Katrina survivor Stephanie Lee. Years later, the magazine profiled Dr. Erez Schat, a scientist at the forefront of using big data and supercomputing to develop novel cures for diseases. After Ms. Lee received a cancer diagnosis, the writers introduced her to Dr. Schat, who is the chairman of the Mount Sinai Department of Genetics and Genomic Sciences and director of the Icahn Institute for Genomics and Multiscale Biology. And the results of that introduction may change the way we treat cancer. Mr. Warren and Mr. Juneau called their story in Esquire Patient Zero. I'm very pleased to welcome all four of the people in this story, the two writers, the doctor, patient, to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Stephanie, by the time you came to know Mark and Tom 8 years ago, hadn't you already been through a lot? How had you met your husband, Terrence?
We both worked at Ingalls Shipbuilding in Pascagoula, Mississippi. He was a welder, and I was a pipe fitter. And I just happened to be walking around and bumped into him one day, and he started smiling at me. And it just went on from there. He just pursued me from there.
And when was he sent to Iraq?
He was sent to Iraq in January of 2005.
You already had a daughter and were pregnant with your second child when Terrence died in Iraq. How was he killed?
He was killed by an IED, a roadside bomb. It hit his Humvee.
And then not long after, Hurricane Katrina pretty much destroyed the Gulf Coast. Weren't you 9 months pregnant at that time?
Yes, I was.
So what did you do?
I got up the next day after Katrina, and it was extremely hot. We didn't have any power, water, gas, anything. And I got in my husband's truck, and I got on OnStar, and I reserved a room in Shreveport, Louisiana. Me and my oldest daughter, we got in the truck, and we drove up to Vicksburg, where we sat in the line to get gas for 3.5 hours. Then we made it to Shreveport, got up that next morning, went to Lowe's to get a generator, but they had a line out the door, so we had to go to the Honda dealership, and I got a generator. I went to Sam's and bought ice and coolers and batteries and flashlights. And then I filled up gas canisters to power the generator when I got home. And we made it back home that Thursday. And I had Marshall that Friday at around 12 o'clock Friday.
And it was okay? You could get into a hospital without any problem?
No problem. When I made it back home to Lucedale, there was no problems going to the hospital, no.
Tom, what were you planning to write about when you met Stephanie?
Well, we were writing about people in the Gulf Coast who had sort of experienced two catastrophes, one being the present catastrophe, which was Hurricane Katrina, and the other was that their loved ones had either been lost in Iraq or were far away from home. So we were basically trying to write about people who were bearing a double burden.
Mark, how did you become aware of Stephanie and her story?
We were down there with Tom, and we had at first met actually Terrence's grandmother, who had raised him, and spent 5 hours with her. And when she said, "Would you like to meet Terrence's baby?" and we didn't know Terrence had a baby. "Would you like to meet Terrence's widow?" We didn't know Terrence was married, and that's how we met Stephanie. And Stephanie and I kept in touch. It was a very, very powerful meeting. Tom can attest to that, and maybe even Stephanie. We kept in touch over the years since, and until we got this note from her in May.
Is it common for sources to stay in touch and even become friends? Don't journalists generally feel a little uncomfortable getting involved in people's personal stories?
I find it goes the other way around. I find that generally, often the people that you talk to are not quite comfortable continuing their relationship. I'm pretty much always, welcoming that, but it's pretty rare. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's fairly rare.
Now, Eric, you run a large genomics institute here in New York, pioneering some of the latest advances in the intersection between medicine and supercomputing. But was that what you thought you would be doing when you joined the Air Force?
It was pretty much the furthest thing I could ever have imagined.
What was your initial goal?
My initial goal, I think, had to do with escape. you know, sort of launching outside a pretty small rural town in Michigan and trying to find myself and going into the military as one avenue of achieving that escape.
And joining the Special Forces.
And joining Special Forces.
So what went wrong or what went right?
So what went very right in retrospect was I was injured significantly enough in my shoulder where I had to have reconstructive surgery, and then that highly physical discipline was out of it for me. And when the commander told me that you're going to have to find something else to do, you can't do this anymore, they had sort of highlighted my mental aptitude on all the tests and had I ever thought about college. And of course, I really didn't know what college was, but began to explore from that point. And once I started college, it all clicked, and here I am.
And you studied pure mathematics, which led you to work in the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, so I started, undergraduate applied math, computer science, then went into graduate school in pure mathematics. But once I achieved PhD candidacy in pure mathematics, I decided I wanted to be more applied. I was very curious about biological systems and how did we evolve, how did we get here, and wanted to then apply mathematics to that discipline. So switched over to a sort of a dual molecular biology applied math.
And Mark and Tom, now, last we were talking to you, you were down in the Gulf Coast. How did you wind up talking with Eric?
Well, I wrote a story about Eric in 2011 when Eric was working for Pacific Biosystems, PacBio, out in Palo Alto. Eric was PacBio was a company that developed and sold these very, very high-end gene sequencers. And I think Eric was using that as his beachhead to connect with virtually everyone in the field of biology that sort of believed as he did. Eric, am I exaggerating there?
No, I think that's absolutely correct.
Well, yeah. Eric, you were at Merck first. Were they eager to support these ideas you had about what you have come to call network biology?
To a point. I mean, a lot of the work that I carried on from Merck started at Merck, and I think there was a big appetite at Merck to see this sort of revolution in biology, a better understanding of disease. But ultimately came to the conclusion that, you know, because pharma companies are really engineered to design single small molecules against a single protein, and what we ultimately were concluding was that, you know, that's not really going to be effective for most diseases. You're going to have to target these networks. That's when it started to get more tension, and I decided that that disruption would have to happen outside of pharma.
Mark, what makes Eric's approach groundbreaking?
Well, Tom, would you care to answer that?
Tom, yeah, what makes Eric's approach groundbreaking?
Well, you know, if you ever have a chance to look at some of these models that Eric makes, they are, you know, Eric is not looking at you know, one gene at a time or one protein at a time or even one pathway of genes and proteins at a time. Eric is trying to look at whole systems in totality. So he's not mining the data for, you know, kind of 1, 2, 3, you know, 15 hits. It's not linear. It's exponential in that he's mining it for the connections between these genes. So the amount of data is enormous. You know, if you have like a million genes, there's like a billion connections or a billion plus or a trillion. And that's what you see in these models that Eric makes. They actually look like, you know, Stephanie's cancer in Eric's model looks like sort of like a portion of the universe, and that's what technology and Eric's approach and this big data approach has enabled us to do at last.
You're right. When Eric was profiled for Esquire 2 years ago, he was an outsider enduring a kind of prestigious exile. So not everybody was going along with this idea, even 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a pretty fundamental paradigm shift in biology where, you know, it's a very reductionist discipline where it's how do these individual proteins work, and if we understand that, we're going to understand all of disease. And that model's kind of failed, as we see in drug discovery. So this idea of saying, well, it can't be just reductionist. It's got to be very holistic. We've got to look at everything simultaneously. That's, you know, not how biologists have been trained over the last 100 years.
So how did you come to be connected with the Icahn Institute at Mount Sinai?
Yeah, so part of the idea with Pacific Biosciences in Palo Alto was to start an institute where we were engaging the digital universe of information to build these kind of predictive models on disease. As we were sort of searching for funding, we locked on to Mount Sinai as a as a path, and Mr. Carl Icahn was very interested in this kind of idea, but they said, you've got to be here in New York City to carry this out. And
so you, unfortunately, you had to move to New York.
So I had to, had to move. Not just me, and I should say, you know, it's not, this game isn't just about Eric. I have you know, an amazing social network of scientists that have are here with me. You know, all the way from the supercomputer side, Jeff Hammerbacher, who is, you know, one of the chief data scientists at Facebook, now here, all the way on through to the network modeling guys, Jun Zhu, and others who really formed the heart of the models that Tom was talking about. It's not just one guy, it's a team.
Stephanie, we haven't forgotten about you. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what happened next in this story. My guests are Stephanie Lee, Tom Juno, Mark Warren, and Dr. Eric Schatt, and stay with us for more. And we are back with Mark Warren, who is executive editor of Esquire, and writer-at-large Tom Juno, and two of the subjects of stories that they've written, Stephanie Lee, who is a survivor of Hurricane Katrina, and Dr. Eric Schatt, who is the chairman of the Mount Sinai Department of Genetics and Genomic Sciences and director of the Icahn Institute for Genomics and Multiscale Biology. Stephanie, when did you learn that you had colon cancer?
I went in to see my PMC, and he sent me to see a GI specialist. And I told the GI specialist about my symptoms, and he said it sounded like I had IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And the only way to diagnose it was to have a colonoscopy. So they scheduled my colonoscopy. They went in and did it and ran into the tumor, which was in my sigmoid colon. They called in a surgeon, and they told me when I woke up, they told me that they found the tumor, and it looks cancerous. So I went in, and I had my surgery May the 9th, and at that point, it was stage 3. That was presumed stage 3. It hadn't spread. And so I had to go, and I had my port placement. Had the port placed in, and a couple of days after I had my port placed, I couldn't breathe. I was having extreme chest pains. So I went to the emergency room, and the surgeon thought maybe he had punctured my chest wall, so they did a CAT scan. And after they did the CAT scan, they put me back in the ER, and one of the ER staff doctors came in, and she said, did you know it spread to your liver? She just out and said it like that. I was like, no. And I just started crying, and she cried with me. And that's how I found out that it was stage 4 colon cancer.
Well, you were an Iraq war widow with 2 kids.
Yeah.
I'm sure you already felt that you had a full plate before this hit you.
Yeah.
And then you had to break this news to your children?
Yes, I did. It was hard to break it to my children and to my mom.
And then is that what led you to decide to reach out to Mark?
I've always been close with Mark, and something just said, let Mark know what's going on. You know, and I didn't think it would escalate to all of this, but something in my mind and my heart told me to reach out to Mark.
And Mark, were you surprised to hear from Stephanie?
It was devastating, actually, to hear from Stephanie. She actually had written me the day that she had had the diagnosis of colon cancer, on May 7th it was. And then over the next weeks, we began to just write back and forth. I learned, you know, what are your doctors saying? How are your kids? How are you feeling? And then we began to talk. And by the time June 10th, which is when she had her port put in, came around, and then June 17th, when she was actually scheduled to begin her chemotherapy for the stage 3 cancer, when she found out she had stage 4 terminal cancer, we had begun to talk every day. And it was... That week, she said she doesn't know why, but that week she asked me if I would walk with her on this walk, and I told her that I would.
And Tom, was it you or Mark who decided to connect Stephanie with Eric?
Well, it was me, but it wasn't, you know, it was the offshoot of even something else. I mean, Mark, as soon as we found out, as soon as Mark found out that Stephanie was sick, I mean, I still remember, you know, the texts and the phone calls that I received from Mark, and it was, as Mark just said, you know, it was devastating to hear. So when I went down, I was actually in New York City to do a start researching a piece on Google that I was writing for a different issue, and you know, how do you write about Google? So I was interested in the sort of the biological research that they are poised to do, and I figured I'd you know, call on Eric, whom I hadn't seen. I've been in touch with Eric frequently since I wrote about him, but I hadn't seen him in New York. The last time I had seen him was in Palo Alto. So I went basically to see the new digs and also to see if he knew anybody at Google, which of course he did, because Eric knows everybody. And so I went down there and, you know, we started talking, and I mentioned pretty much right off the bat that Stephanie was sick. And I explained who Stephanie was and explained the diagnosis that she received. And Eric said immediately, that's exactly the kind of patient we take.
Well, Stephanie, weren't you rather young to contract colon cancer? Did that lead the doctors you were dealing with in Mississippi to take particular interest in you?
My GI doctor looked at me when he saw it. He was like shocked. He was in absolute shock. He was like, "You're so young. You're so young." And I don't know of any other patients with my diagnosis at Keesler. I just know I'm the youngest patient with colon cancer there, which, you know, the doctors can't disclose the other patient's information to you. So, I mean, I just went with the protocol. I just said, well, I want to go ahead and handle this and take care of it and see if I can fight it and do what you have to do. But from what I know, I'm the youngest patient they have there.
Eric, was that one of the things that interested you in her cancer?
Yeah, it was a point of interest, but I wouldn't say it was you know, something that made or broke our decision to take her case on. You know, part of what we're doing in trying to understand the cancer is also to understand one's risk of developing that cancer. So looking in your germline and understanding whether you have those mutations that you could have passed on to your kids or were passed on to you. So those are things we look at. It was an interesting thing, but not the primary thing.
And Mark, what were the odds of Stephanie's survival if she just continued receiving treatment, even if it was really good treatment in Mississippi?
Very poor. I spoke to her oncologist in the course of reporting the story, and he explained, and as any oncologist probably and similarly situated, that people who are stage 4 metastatic disease, they expect to be fatal. And even if the chemotherapy is initially successful or effective, they expect the disease to come back. They don't know when, but they expect it to come back.
Eric, you have a team working for you, gene sequencing, a supercomputer named Minerva. What was your team able to understand about Stephanie's tumor?
Yeah, so we, you know, sequenced the DNA and RNA in Stephanie's tumor. We sequenced the DNA in her germline, which is what you're born with. Then we compare those two to understand how did the tumor mutate? What were the mutations that occurred that caused her to get cancer and then that causes it to progress into something more serious like metastatic disease? So we were able to identify what the key drivers of that tumor was and then match that up to existing treatments or treatments coming through clinical trials to try to assess whether she would respond, her tumor maybe would respond better to alternative treatments.
Tom, how much more can Eric's analysis tell us about a tumor than what doctors would have been able to know just a couple of decades ago?
Well, I mean, I think that it's, I used the metaphor of the universe before, and I think there's something about that when, you know, you peer into the universe with the naked eye, you can, or even with a high-powered telescope, you can see pretty far. But when you peer into the universe using data, that's how they're finding all these new planets. These planets are there, and they basically show up as disturbances of data or of patterns of data. And that's essentially what Eric is starting to see. He's seeing pathways turned on and that seem active in these cancers that basically I don't think that anybody has been able to see before.
But, Eric, isn't there such a thing as having too much information? I've heard one of the major critiques of big data is that there's too often too much to sort through, and you don't know what's important and what isn't.
Yeah, so that's a great segue maybe into the type of modeling we do. Certainly, we're newer to the game in cancer. There are wonderful centers, you know, whether it's Baylor Medicine or MD Anderson or TGen or Broad, great centers. But how we're differentiating ourselves is how do we look at all that digital universe of information that exists in the public domain and that exists on a given patient. And there's no such thing as having too much information. It's do you have the framework? Do you have the ability to organize that information in a framework that enhances your understanding? And that's really the aim that we have at Mount Sinai, to create that kind of a framework for better understanding.
Mark, what was the strategy most doctors wanted to use to shrink Stephanie's tumors?
Traditional chemotherapy. There's a protocol for colorectal cancer that has been used for decades. It's called FOLFOX6. Some people respond to it, some people don't. Stephanie actually responded very well, creating an opportunity for surgery, which is tremendous, actually, because that gives Eric's team that much more time.
Well, what was the hope that Eric's analysis could do something for Stephanie?
Well, that week when we first talked to Eric, when Tom first talked to Eric, he called me excitedly, and that afternoon I called Eric and told him specifically about Stephanie's case. And he told me prospectively what they would try to do, what this study was doing that they've started, this small-scale study. And at the end he said, "Mark, it's a long shot. I put it at 1 in 1,000.
What about you, Stephanie? Did you have much faith in Eric's team and their analysis?
Yes, I did. I had a lot of faith in him. Yes, and anybody that gave me hope, I have faith in them.
Eric, Mark, and Tom's story is called Patient Zero. Was Stephanie the first patient that you've worked with?
So she was not the very first, but certainly among the first. You know, we started this program, you know, 6-9 months ago and have taken on maybe 20-plus cases. So she's definitely in the mix of the first ones coming through, where we're, again, trying to understand how do we work within this complicated medical framework to enhance decision-making in a clinical setting.
I don't know which one of you to ask this question, but maybe I'll throw it to Tom. Why were Stephanie's mutated genes eventually transplanted into a fruit fly?
Well, I was just about to talk about the Stephanie fly. We can't have this conversation without talking about the Stephanie fly.
No, I have some fruit flies in my house. Should I supply them? To you, Eric,
absolutely.
To say you can do future
absolutely.
Research.
Well, you know, it was when you know the journey that we started on here in late June, you know, went throughout the whole summer, and it took a while to get the tissue for Eric to sequence and stuff, and so it was a sort of an ongoing challenge till the end of September or the beginning of October. And I think that Eric was hoping to find in his, in his sequencing and in the data that he got what Eric had called a hard-hitting mutation, a novel mutation that would seem to come as a surprise to everybody, and you could treat that. And I think to Eric's and our initial disappointment, didn't find that. It was sort of a standard colorectal cancer profile. But Eric immediately started, you know, reaching out to other people at Sinai. And one of the people he reached out to was a researcher named Ross Kagan, who had just started in September, basically starting to load fruit flies with the mutations that Eric was uncovering in his own data profiles. And so he started immediately creating flies that essentially had, you know, Stephanie's tumor. And the reason that they do that is they test existing treatment compounds against those mutations and against those tumors and to see what responds. And he, you
well,
know,
do fruit flies have colons?
Eric?
So I'm not a fruit fly expert. We needed Ross Kagan here. But they do have something that resembles a colon. So you can give a fly what has all the appearances of a colon cancer and can actually metastasize just as in Stephanie's case.
So what is the goal here, to analyze someone's genes and then develop a customized drug?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we can do from the molecular side of things, as I indicated earlier, is what are the key drivers in Stephanie that are driving her tumor? We can then bang those into the fruit fly. And then, as Tom was saying, we can high-throughput screen that fruit fly against all existing drugs that are on the market, that are coming through trials. We can screen all combinations of those drugs and see which one of those specifically knocks down that patient's tumor.
And Stephanie, you were the fifth patient in the world to have a fruit fly profile.
I know. I love to see my flies. Like, it's just amazing to me. I'm like, Mark, you didn't tell me about this fly.
Well, what course of treatment did you want for Stephanie, Eric? What drugs did you wind up identifying?
So we identified a number of drugs through this screen that were targeting certain signaling pathways that we had also identified as part of Stephanie's tumor that our data suggested she may benefit from. So there were a number of investigational drugs coming through clinical trials that may benefit Stephanie.
And then you gave her drugs, but was there also a surgery, Stephanie?
Yes, I had surgery October 25th, and they removed four tumors, and one they couldn't locate, so they ablated the area. They removed my gallbladder.
Everybody, the prognosis right now is good?
Right now, I haven't talked to my oncologist over at Keesler. I have an appointment to see him next Monday because I start chemotherapy again. But when I was talking to my surgeon, he was like, it's in the air right now, just know, to see where I'm going to go for us with the chemotherapy and the treatment to see how it's going to fight the cancer off.
It should be noted that they when they removed her tumors at Ochsner Hospital in New Orleans, they flash froze one of the tumors and immediately sent it to Eric's lab at Mount Sinai for sequencing.
This story has so many different twists and turns from the last decade: Hurricane Katrina, the Iraq War, the rise of big data, personalized medicine. You couldn't have written a novel with all of these things. Thank you all so much for being on our show, Mark Warren, Tom Juno, Stephanie Lee, and Dr. Eric Schatt. It has been a fascinating conversation, and we do have a link to your article on our show page at WNYC.org.